Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Cory Booker, a 1997 graduate of Yale Law School, was elected mayor of Newark, New Jersey in 2006. A former Newark councilman, known for his innovative solutions to the problems of urban life, Mayor Booker returned to the law school as the keynote speaker for the 10th annual Arthur Lyman Public Interest Law Colloquium, a gathering of academics and practitioners who are involved in a range of social justice issues.
Thank you, everybody. It is absolutely tremendous to be here back home. And it's amazing the feelings I'm getting just walking these hallways or driving around coming here. But it's particularly amazing for me to be invited here for this 10th anniversary of the Lyman Fellowship. I joked with a friend of mine as I was getting ready to come up here that I was coming up to give a speech about public interest, and when I was a law student, I had this full of idealism and vigor, and I thought that clearly I remember the Charles Hamilton Houston quote that either you're a lawyer for the public interest or you're a leech upon society. And my friend laughed at me and looked at me and said, well, now you're a politician. what does that say for you? And I said, indeed, you're right. The word politics comes from that Latin root, poly meaning many and tix meaning blood-sucking vermin. It's been an interesting path in my life that has led me to have my mother very depressed when I became a lawyer, and now even more depressed as she thinks I'm devolving now as a politician. She's wondering when I'm going to open up my used car salesmanship to have a trifecta. But I'm excited and encouraged more that I'll have a chance to dialogue with you all and in this room, and I'm hoping that we can get to the questions after some brief comments from me. But the reality is I'd love to hear from you and what's on your mind and how in many ways you see the world and how I might be able to in some way comment on that vision. But I want to start just really jumping in on how I got to where I am. And there's an old saying that says the best way to make God laugh is to make plans for yourself. And if you had told me, in fact, I read my journal from 1996, that one day I would be an elected official, I would have laughed because it seemed like such an incalculably a rare possibility that I would actually be in electoral politics at this point in my life. But I had ideals, and I had them in spades when I was in law school. And I studied the law and read about it, but the truth of the matter is, a lot of the things my parents said to me when I was growing up really rang in my heart. You see, my parents were involved in the civil rights movement and had such incredible stories to tell about the ugliest aspects of this country. From my father, who was involved in the sit-in movement in the early 60s in North Carolina, stories of being kicked and spit on and having hot coffee poured on him or his friends. And my mother had stories about what it was like in the D.C. and what it was like working with the Urban League, trying to break open many companies that weren't hiring African Americans. My father, who was one of the first black salesmen ever hired by Woodrow and Latham, a department store, then became one of the first black salesmen for Sinclair Oil. Then my mom and him became some of the first black employees for IBM on the East Coast. And my dad, again, had these chilling stories about going to make sales calls for typewriters or whatever he was selling and having people look at his card and rip it up and throw it in his face and say, you know, you tell IBM not to send any more niggers out here to sell me typewriters. And then my parents, when they moved to New Jersey back in 1969, the year I was born, they had an incredibly horrific experience in their eyes of being denied housing everywhere they looked in white neighborhoods. And eventually, thanks to some amazing lawyers for the public interest, they concocted a scheme, a sting operation, where they got a white couple to pose as them and follow them after they would go to houses to look at them. And they would not meet the real estate agent beforehand. They'd always ask to meet the real estate agent at the site. As soon as the agent saw my parents, they sort of took aback and would give them this line that the house was already sold or it had been pulled off the market. And one house that my parents really loved, they were told that it was still, that it was sold, and my parents were frustrated. They left, and the white couple came. Ironically, their name was Mr. and Mrs. Brown, but they were not brown. But the white couple went, and indeed the house was still for sale. They put a bid on the house for my parents on the day of the closing. My father and the young lawyer showed up at the real estate agent's house, at the real estate agent's office, and the real estate agent stood there and seen my father walk in, and the young lawyer stood up there really proud and said, you are in violation of New Jersey fair housing law. I now am commanding you to present a contract for the Bookers, and we'll close on this house using the real name of the purchaser. And the lawyer didn't even get a chance to finish. This hulking real estate agent stood up, grabbed the contract out of the lawyer's hands, and punched the lawyer in the face. He fell flat out, a dog on my dad. There was this big melee in the office, and it ended up with the real estate agent on his knees sobbing and begging my parents not to move into this town, that we would ruin the town, and begging us not to do it. But indeed, my parents did move into the town, becoming, as my father used to affectionately call us, the four raisins in a tub of vanilla ice cream. And so this is where I grew up. After a long journey that got my parents into this town in affluent white middle-class New Jersey. And I sat at the table with busts, literally with busts of presidents on my kitchen table as I ate my eggs in the morning, as my parents tried to give me lessons about this democracy that didn't really become real for me until I got involved in doing public interest work. And they told me about a nation that was formed in these perfect ideals and this dream and this vision that in no way was real. In fact, the reality was a savagely imperfect reality. And that the history of our democracy is a history of ordinary people doing extraordinary things to make real on this democracy. And that indeed, there is no such thing as a natural evolution of America, that it does not naturally drift from injustice to justice, that every inch of ground has to be paid for and fought for. And in fact, the ideals themselves, or the written word itself, this Constitution that we study and we look at so closely here in law school, that it itself is not a document that in any way naturally bends towards justice. It was a document in and of itself that sustained systems of injustice that lasted for years and years and years until people with a different spirit or different dreams and ideals were able to claim the justice that this country deserves and demands. Now, these are things I would hear from my parents. I'd hear them in lectures from my parents. I'd hear them in commands, and I still have these conversations with my parents today. And I find myself overwhelmed as I try to cling to or find the values that I think have really made this country, not necessarily unique, but this country stand tall in ways that I am proud of. And to me, if there's anything that makes this country manifest, it is two concepts that I continually encounter in Newark. And one is having a real prophetic vision for who we are as a nation and as a people. And the second thing is having an enduring, profound love for humanity, a love so deep and so daring that often it is marked most importantly by self-sacrifice and by a commitment beyond that which many people would willingly walk. So this is where I entered Newark, still searching for my understanding of myself, still searching for my understanding of what it meant to pursue these ideals that my parents talked about and that I studied here. And I found myself still a law student deciding that I was gonna rent an apartment in Newark. And that I was, sort of crazy in a blind idealism, that I decided I was gonna find the worst place I could find in Newark and rent an apartment, and I was gonna do good. And I couldn't find any apartments in the place that people told me. And the place people told me not to live was, Chris Rock has this joke. He says, why is it the most violent street in every city is named after the man that stood for nonviolence? And I moved on to Martin Luther King Boulevard. And I couldn't find an apartment, and I could only find a boarding house for recovering drug addicts right next to a crack house that was nicknamed Happy House. And so I took this room as I was driving back and forth between classes here and an occasional night or two in this room. And my first month there on this street was one of the scariest months of my life. And I'll never forget that I was walking down the street in my first month and just started witnessing this drug trade that was unbelievable, so much so that I would sit in my window. And I had worked everywhere from East Harlem to East Palo Alto, California. I'd never seen people move pharmaceutical products in a way that would put Rite Aid to shame. And I used to sit out there just looking at my window, watching these men trade drugs and seeing white folks and black folks and Latino folks and rich folks and poor folks, truck drivers and Mercedes-Benzes coming through to buy drugs. And in my first month there, I was jogging down my street and I found a body bludgeoned to death on the street corner. In my first month there, I would watch out my back window and see people coming back. And again, all different races and socioeconomic people, different levels of income, sitting there strapping on surgical tubing and injecting IV drugs. And in my first month there, I came out once and I was walking down, and I've had this reflexive issue ever since I started going to schools like Stanford and Yale, where you see black folk that aren't necessarily the majority, but you have this understanding that when you pass somebody that's African American, you give them the nod, and you okay, I'm okay, things are all right. And I see this African American man who looks like me, is my size, is my build, and I just reflexively give him an affirmation of his humanity and say hello. And he jumps off of his perch where he was standing, what was called the wall back then, in front of these high-rise projects, looks me in the eye and says, I don't know who the blank you are, I don't know where the blank you come from, but if you ever so much as eyeball me again, I'm going to bust a cap in your posterior region. And you have to understand, I'm a former All-American football player, I had strength records at Stanford, and I look at this man and I go, okay. And I just walk on back to my little cubicle in this room I was renting. And so this was my introduction. And in some senses, I thought my idealism might have outpaced my sanity. And I walked into a world that seemed so confusing that here was a person trying to search for, in many ways, my beacon of hope, my beacon of light, these ideals that were so lofty to me in study and so lofty to me in my parental stories, that I was searching for them. And yet I encountered this world that was so, in many ways, seemed hostile to my presence there. And I'll never forget that my friend of mine, who was running a nonprofit in Newark called Do Something, said, well, the person that's in charge of that neighborhood is a woman named Miss Virginia Jones. You gotta meet Miss Virginia Jones. And so I went to meet this woman. I snuck around the back of the projects to avoid the line of drug dealers and went up to her stairwell and knocked on her door. She lived on the fifth floor, apartment 5A, I'll never forget, and knocked on her door, and I hear this booming voice, who is it? And I said, my name is Cory Booker, and then she swung the door open. I'm looking up, thinking I'm going to see some Herculean figure, and I look down, and it's a 4'11" old woman standing there with her arm crossed, looking. I said, "What do you want?" And I looked at her and I said, "Well, my name is Cory Booker. I'm from Yale Law School, ma'am. I'm here to help you." And she looks at me and said, "What?" And I sort of tried to explain myself again with the bravado I had of an ambitious, idealistic individual, and with a definitely a degree of arrogance. And she looks at me and she says, "You want to help me?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "You really want to help me?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, follow me." And she pushes past me, and she walks down these five flights of stairs. She goes out into through the lobby of the building. She walks out the front of the building through the line of drug dealers, at which point I'm standing very close to her, and stands in the middle of the street and swings around, and she says to me, "Tell me what you see." And I say, "What?" She goes, "Tell me what you see, boy." And I said, "What do I see?" I said, "I see the projects, I see a crack house, I see drug dealers," which I said in a very low and respectful tone, and I said, I sort of described the neighborhood. And she says, "Well, you'll never be able to help me," and she turns around and she starts walking away. And I hustle after her and sort of tap her on the shoulder insistently, and I said, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "Boy, you need to understand something. That the world you see outside of you is a reflection of what you got inside of you. And if you're one of those people who only sees problems and darkness and despair, that's all there's ever going to be. But if you're one of those people who sees hope, opportunity, love, God, then you're one of those people that can help me and make a change." And she stormed off. And it was this moment that I was sort of shocked as she said some of the more profound words that were uttered to me in my life. And I just stood there watching her disappear through the drug dealers into the projects, and I stood there suddenly feeling very naked and exposed, and I turned around and went back to my apartment. I just sat there and I thought about her words. And again, I had read words so similarly than that. Emerson said, "That only which we have within can we see without. If you see no angels, it's because you harbor none." And in many ways, I was there because of the prophetic vision of others, people who saw in a country that never gave them substance to back up their vision, people who saw in their nation something that was not there, but something so compelling that it got some of the people who were most subjugated by this country and this nation and its ideals and its laws to reach out and do something. I sat recently in a lecture in Newark by a Yale professor of history, Professor Blight, who talked about the history of this nation and talked about the signing of the Martin Luther King holiday by Ronald Reagan, and how he was personally offended, he said, when Reagan was signing this. And in his words, he talked about figures like Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King because of their adherence to law and order. And if you think about it, there is nothing that was orderly or law-abiding about most of the movements for social justice in our city. These were people who challenged the very order of things. But why were they doing it, and what was their compelling nature to have a belief or a faith that the fight was even worth it? And to me, it was like this woman who stood there and challenged me. It was a vision of what was possible. It was a vision that reflected her very heart and her very spirit. You know, I went back to Miss Jones, and I ended up sitting in her living room. It was packed with newspapers. She was she still is a pack rat, and things were all over the place. I'd sit at her kitchen table as she was making food, and I just listened. And I joke with people now. I say I got my BA from Stanford, but my PhD on the streets of Newark. And this was just in the final days of my time up here at Yale, just listening to this woman as I began to plot with the Urban Justice Center exactly what I'd be doing with my fellowship. And hearing this woman's stories and the battles and the challenges and the fights, and I just sat there in humble reverence to this woman who was manifesting or evidencing so much of what I aspire to be in my life, so much of what I wanted to do. Hearing stories about how she and the other leaders within that building would huddle young people together, knowing it was too dangerous to play outside, and they would take their pennies, no government program, no nothing, to provide St. Patrick's Day parties, and there wasn't an Irish person within 100 miles, it seemed, from where they were. They would hold Valentine's Day events. They would go on field trips. It was the most amazing experience to listen to her talk about what she was doing. And I began to hear, again, words of my ancestors. There's a wonderful book by Alice Walker, In Search of My Mother's Garden, and she has this chapter about the black revolutionary. And she says that the real black revolutionary is always concerned with the least glamorous of things. The recording history for old folks, the raising a child's grade level from reading level from third grade to fourth, the filling out food stamps for other folk in the neighborhood because they must eat revolution or not. The real black revolutionary never leaves their people and is always around such that they can be of service. And so here was this revolutionary woman, this great American that I began to know and that her colleagues were fighting in this building. And thank God, as I graduated from this school and passed the bar, I began to join them in helping them achieve what they saw and their vision. And we were creative in it. And this idea of innovation is so critically important. If we who are of faith in this room believe we were created in the image of God, then certainly the most important power we must have been given was that idea that we can create, that we can innovate, that we have the ability to make anew, or reaffirm, or reassert, or reinvent who we are. So we sat there in these tenant meetings. It first began with 15 to 20 of us, and I remember saying to Miss Jones, "This is not enough, Miss Jones," and she started giving me lectures about Gideon's army and God didn't need everybody. We got all the people we need, and me insisting that I had some strategies I learned from dorms. We can get more people, and she said, "Well, what?" And I said, "Well, if we get pizza, people will come to the meetings." and she said, "Okay, we'll try." And so we bought pizza and food, and sure enough, folks showed up. And we started getting this good posse together, and I started giving little mini law lectures about what the rights of people in public housing or in HUD subsidized housing, more specifically, what rights they had. And we started strategizing, well, what can we do to assert our rights and assert our powers? And I remember some folks had, so, well, who's responsible? And other people would argue, but we're responsible. And I said, well, there are some people that are legally responsible. We are morally responsible. And we had these amazing dialogue and back and forth. And we finally came up with a strategy that we would, with about 200, 250 residents, we would call the one HUD bureaucrat we could find and isolate as the person most responsible. And in 1 week, every person would call 10 times, and they would read exactly why that person was at fault for allowing to have it happen. And for the first time in what seemed like years, as I was told, some white folks showed up in suits, not to buy drugs in front of the building, but actually to come inside and come to the meeting and figure out why they were being bothered by this group of mostly senior citizen African-American activists. And it was an amazing thing. And in a very short span of time, I watched the world transform in front of my eyes. HUD came in and worked with the residents to get the owner of these HUD subsidized buildings convicted in federal court. The drug dealers, the residents worked against them, literally setting up card tables to play cards in their turf and talk to some of the kids. And we actually ended the drug trade in front of the buildings. We lobbied the city government and got the crack house torn down in the buildings. We were able to work with local corporation, lobbying them to get Prudential to adopt the local school and put a healthcare center. It was this amazing experience for me. to bear witness and be a small part of this phenomenal transformation. But it all stemmed from this ideal. And the ideal was probably put best by another interaction I had with a resident towards the end of this. We were having a block party, and I was just so amazed by what was going on and feeling very self-satisfied and, again, big for my britches and indulging probably in a dabble of arrogance. And this woman comes up to me whose mother died during the many months that we were in this fight. And I said, it's a shame that your mother couldn't live to see this. And this woman looks at me and she goes, what are you talking about, Corey? My mother always saw this, and that's probably why we're seeing it now. This is the power of having a prophetic vision for who we are and understanding that laws were made to serve our highest ideals, not to be rigid restrictions upon what we can do. And if those laws are not infused with love, if the laws are not infused with our highest ideals, then they will always work against the public interest. There must be people front and center in the trenches willing to fight that fight, willing to be there to ensure that the great revolution that manifested this nation continues on a daily basis. Now, I got involved in politics as a result of a lot of the activism that we were doing. And I was swept into office, and I'll never forget my first year in office was probably one of my most discouraging years of my life. I felt literally impotent against the machines of government and very frustrated continually by what I was seeing going on and discouraged. And one of my most discouraging days, though, did not happen inside City Hall. It happened when I was walking into Brick Towers, now where I lived, after making a promise to Ms. Jones that I would not leave the neighborhood even after I got elected. And I see T-Bone coming over to me. And T-Bone looks at me and says, yo, let's go for a ride. And I said, your car or mine, T-Bone? And I hadn't seen him in a while, and we got into a car and we drove up South Orange Avenue. Now, in Newark, the South Orange Avenue is a very historic street, but it runs out of Newark, right past Seton Hall, and it's almost like the old Wizard of Oz movie that is in black and white, and then as soon as something happens, you suddenly go to Technicolor. It's amazing how segregated the state of New Jersey is, and one of the most segregated states in the nation, more so than many of the southern states you might imagine. And here, suddenly, we were in a place of huge houses and affluent neighborhoods, good schools, and me and this other African-American gentleman, we pull over on the side of the road, and T-Bone turns to me and says, yo, man, you've got to help me. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, well, you got to help me get out of here. And I still didn't understand what he meant. And I thought that he wanted me to help him get into some programs that we were trying to get going to help other guys who were involved in drug dealing out. But he basically quickly explained to me that he had warrants out for his arrest and had warrants out for some pretty horrible things. And I won't glorify any of them. And I was just sort of found myself in this awkward position of trying to counsel this guy to turn himself in, to actually go to prison, because I knew he would. And here we go as we start sitting there, and suddenly something happened. He looks at me hard and begins to tell me about his life story. And what shocked me and silenced me was that he told me the exact same life story up until about the age of 12 or 13, the exact same life story as my father, exactly the same. Both of them were born in extreme poverty. Both of them were born to a single mother who could not take care of them. Both of them were eventually taken in by their grandmothers, but they were both too rambunctious, let's say, for their grandmothers to either handle. And then eventually, by the time they were 10, 11, or 12, both of them were turned out into the streets. In my dad's segregated town in the mountains of North Carolina, he ended up being taken in by a family that raised him and served in many ways like his parents. He called them so even when I was growing up. And T-Bone was taken in by the street community, by a gang, and began to get involved and start to ratchet up a juvenile crime record and then eventually an adult crime record. And as he's sitting there telling me this, I'm half listening to him now, and I'm staring at this man who in every way now I'm looking at my dad, and in every way I'm looking at a mirror image of myself, a man that I used to, when I first moved to Newark, sit there and watch him operate this street-level drug trade with fascination. Suddenly he woke me up from my sort of tangential daydreaming, and suddenly he looked at me with this vicious ferocity with which he looked at me when he had first threatened my life. And suddenly he just looked, he bit down hard on his lip, and then he burst into tears and started crying like a little child and sobbing into my dashboard. And it was at that point that I felt an alienation from another human being that I don't think I had ever felt before. This man, this mirror image of myself in so many ways, was at that point so alienated from me and so distant that even though we were just sitting inches from each other in a car seat, I felt we were separated by a chasm or a canyon that I could not help to traverse, no matter what I did. And we had this awkward sort of gathering of each other ourselves. He sort of got himself back together. We drove back down to the Bulli, the Martin Luther King Boulevard, and this young man disappeared despite my imploring him to get a lawyer, to try to help him get and the like. And I'll never forget that moment in my life because it was a point where I was feeling so broken by the challenges I was having in City Hall, the challenges of being a so-called reformer when you had really no power to get anything done, where I was being outvoted consistently, where the mayor was having joy making my life difficult, ticketing my car everywhere I parked in the city, the Star-Ledger and we revealed that my phones were being tapped by the municipal police. Here I was so frustrated with what was going on in my life that now I felt this other frustration, that I saw around me these creeping problems that were continuing to aggravate the state of my country, the state of African Americans, the state of my ideals. That I was actually standing in a city that two generations ago, white supremacists were shooting and gunning down African Americans, James Meredith, Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King, and now here I was in a city where black on black violence was just spiraling out of control. That two generations ago, they were literally infecting black people with diseases, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which some of you, I'm sure, know about. And here I was seeing so many people, young kids especially, being infected with AIDS, and many of them due to reckless behavior. In addition to that, I was thinking that four generations ago, they were literally holding African Americans in bondage and in slavery. And now I was watching about 25% of the young black men my age in my city being involved in the penal system, and not as lawyers and judges, but behind bars and in chains. And it was this frustrating moment that I'll never forget that man began to challenge me in ways that challenged my very ideals about public service. Because now I was fighting a situation that you had a clash of ideals. I had residents demanding more law enforcement, demanding tougher sentences, demanding that we get the drug dealers and end the violence in the neighborhoods. I also had prisoners coming out of prison who were telling me about the unconscionable stories of the obstacles that were before them that often ended up having them slipping back in. All this was playing out in the context of governance, which was not doing anything, it's in my knowledge, to address these issues at all. The very gears were ground up with a perversion, even though no laws were necessarily being broken. The very institution itself that was supposed to be serving the highest interests and highest ideals was being perverted and ground to a halt. And in many ways, in Newark, there was an absence of the kind of activism that many cities had, or independent lawyerism that many cities had, or independent research that other cities had that would help focus on problems and end the sclerotic breakup of or clogs of our very gears. And this led to a next level of activism, where I joined with some of the most amazing heroes again to try to begin to shake and wake people up from what we were doing. Harold mentioned about the hunger strike that we did. And that was born out of an incredible frustration for us trying to get people just to pay attention to what the problems were. I remember coming home one night, and it was Miss Jones again that was standing there and said to me very pointedly, what's wrong? And I told her that, oh, it was a horrible day, that some projects had been taken over by some drug dealers who had attacked the local security company. The security company quit. There was no protection, no guidance. And she looks at me and says, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, I don't know. I said, I'm a councilman. I don't control the police department. I gave her all these excuses why I couldn't do anything. And she crosses her arms again. She says, well, I know what you should do. And I said, really? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, what should I do? She goes, I know what you should do. And I said, really, Miss Jones? She goes, yeah. I said, what should I do? She repeats herself again, I know what you should do, boy. And I'm like, okay, Miss Jones, tell me what I should do. And she goes, well, what you should do something. And I look at this woman, and I said, something. And she goes, yeah, do something. And I remember going back up to my room, angry at her, angry at my situation, feeling sorry for myself, and then realizing after calling some of my friends that we should do something, that even in the face of implacable odds, even in the face of towering opposition, just getting out there and being in the mix. And I'll never forget, I got my, who's now my deputy chief of staff, at the time was my chief of staff, we went out and bought a tent, we set it up, and we said to the drug dealers, we're not gonna fight you guys, but we're not leaving here until you stop what you're doing, and we're willing to help you in any way possible. And we spent a long night of getting everything from food to feces thrown on top of the tent, and we just sat there. But the next morning, it was amazing to me. And the next morning, the news cameras all came out to figure out who the suicidal maniacs were on the pavement. And we gave interviews, and we said, this is the United States of America, which is supposed to stand for ideals so profound. And how could we have people living in terror within our own communities? And I'll never forget, I challenged them to put the people who live there on the news. They interviewed people who told horrible stories. And before you knew it, by the end of that day, after putting it all on the news, people just started coming out. First, it was 10 hulking security guards from the local correctional, maximum security correctional institution who came out and said, we're not going to let you stay out here alone. And they started taking up stations and engaging the drug dealers. Next thing you knew, there were community leaders, there were ministers coming out offering to fast with me. By the end of 10 days, you had hospitals there, businesses there, you had churches there, mosques there. We used to hold prayer circles out every morning. It went from having 5 people in a prayer circle to over 250 people from every different faith represented in our city, holding hands. People had donated computers to the local rooms. You had NYU students coming over to sleep under the tent. It was amazing transformation that happened, again, because of the constructive imagination of people like Miss Jones or Jermaine James, my young aide. So I say all of this to tell you and to try to drive home that one point. It has very little to do with much of the practicality that goes on in our lifestyle, but the reality is it must have everything to do with who we are about as a people. I'm now mayor of the largest city in my state, and I'm now sitting in the crucible, in many days, a frustrating crucible, trying to make up for so much of the things that happened before me as a city, trying to take an institution and breathe a life into it or an idealism into it to make sure that our values are made manifest and not the values of individuals or a particular group of leaders, but the values that we hold in our society. I set as a mission of my city, and I've sat with my senior staff, we did another day-long retreat just talking about our values, our ideals, and our vision. And we said that we have nothing less than the vision for our cities to set a national standard for urban transformation, that it's going to live up to the very best of what we think of ourselves, and that we are going to have Newark once again, as it did when it defended Washington's army from retreating from the British, as it did into the Industrial Revolution, as it did in the 1930s when it was on the front page of Harper's Magazine as the most livable city in America, that we in Newark, as humble as that we are, our ambition is to be the most amazing city in this country to show light and hope where there has not been for a long time. And this city has incredible problems and staggering realities. I have open office hours where once a month at least, I sit and let anybody who wants to come see me come sit in my office hours. Sometimes I sit there for literally 10 hours as people come to me. Some of them blow me away, and they just want to have 20 minutes with me to tell me what their idea is to help the city. But often I see people, guys coming out of prison, people on public assistance, people homeless, desperate for help. It's an amazing reminder to me about the substance of what we are trying to do, which is to make real on the greatest and grandest visions we have for our city. But I'm going to end and allow you all to ask me questions, but I'm going to end with this just one return to my reality, what I'm living. So I lived in Brick Towers for 10 years. I just moved out. 8 years. I just moved out. And after we got the slumlord convicted, the feds came in, took over the projects, things turned around, started to get better. We had a guy that was willing to buy the buildings. I ran for mayor. I lost the election. The mayor came in and said, you will not sell these buildings to this developer, and said, my housing authority is going to take it over, which was a death knell. When the city housing authority came in and took over, everything went to hell in a handbasket. And the buildings started falling apart. Residents began to realize they couldn't hold up anymore. Many of them moved out. We didn't have heat and hot water. I kept talking with Ms. Jones on a daily basis, saying to her, if you move out, I will move, but I'm not going to move until you move. The buildings kept grinding down until there was maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 families left living in the buildings as we were trying to hold on until this current election, which I just won. During this time, though, of 4 years of being out of the political context, working through a nonprofit, sort of living in a building that was under the heel of the current mayor, I had some of my darkest days where I watched some of my closest friends who were the believers in light and in love, who were prophetic visionaries, say that they could not hold out in Brick Towers anymore. They had to leave, see them leave Brick Towers and go, and often go into other bad situations. It was a breakup of the very family that I had in Brick Towers. And I remember that this constant deterioration and my hope, again, that I was going to win an election that many people said was very difficult. It was during this time that I felt I probably reached one of the lowest points in my life, the nadir, when I was growing frustration, where I was having a tough time holding on to that which has sustained our nation, our ideals for ourselves, and the love which I've talked about. And I was walking around, it was actually the week of my birthday, and I was walking around my neighborhood and gunshots rang out. And I turned around towards the gunfire as it was echoing like cannon fire between a set of projects, and a whole bunch of children were running down a hill, and I sprinted through the kids towards the gunfire that seemed to be still ringing in my ears. And I got there as another young man was stumbling backwards off the steps. He fell into my arms, and I looked over his shoulder, and his chest was filling up with this red blood. And I looked down and sort of held him, tried to hold the blood into his chest to stop it. He started coughing and gagging, and foamy red blood just started pouring out of his mouth. I'm screaming at people to please call an ambulance, please call an ambulance. And as I also screamed to tell somebody to tell me who he was, what was his name. And I sat there in probably one of the more uncomfortable moments of my life, just whispering in Wazin's ears, his name was Wazin Miller, whispering in his ears saying, stay with me, not knowing anything of what to do, just holding my hands in this boy's bloody chest. It seemed like a whirlwind was going on around me. So much was flashing through my mind as I sat there just trying to hold this child. As his breathing stopped, as I reached into his mouth, not knowing what I was reaching for, trying to clear the foamy blood out of his mouth, hoping that he would just start breathing again, And the ambulance finally came, pushed me out of the way, ripped open his shirt, where I now saw three gunshot wounds in his front and one in his side, and he was dead. And I just stood there as cops asked me questions, and I tried to articulate whatever I had witnessed to them. And I went home that night, and I went into my apartment, and I was done. I went into an apartment with no heat and no hot water, and I saw that my dream that I invested in, this idea that this community could stay together, could withstand politics, could withstand this community that had in so many ways showed me light and hope that was now being threatened and being choked. I just sat there in the sink and just tried to wipe this kid's blood off of me. And I remember scrubbing his blood and starting to cry into the sink and continuing to scrub. And even after the blood was gone, I just still felt his blood on my hands. And I just got angry, and I'll tell you, I got angry at my country, a country that could have a perverse obsession with the murder of young white girls, Natalie Holloway or JonBenet Ramsey, and yet black boys and girls were dying all the time in my city, and nobody even knew their names. And Wazin's name kept ringing in my mind, and I got angry about it, and more angry. And I felt myself indulging in something that I rarely do. I tend to often have a sense of just bold optimism about the world, but I had it. And I was just slamming my hands on the sink and went into my bedroom and lay down around space heaters that seemed to be the only hope for heat in this decaying building. And I sat up through the night, in and out of sleep, and I woke up the next morning and came down in the elevator, which blissfully was working, and often it wasn't. Residents had to walk 16 flights, for those who lived on my floor. And I come out into the lobby, and there I see Miss Jones's head. And this woman is now in my life a pain in my ass, but she is also an amazing a vision of power for me. And just seeing in the back of her head, I stopped and stared. She didn't see me. I just stopped and stared. And one story from her life, I found myself holding on to like an anchor to keep me rooted in who I was, or it's like a lifeline to pull myself out of where I was at that point. And it was a simple story that she told me that blew me away. And it was a story of her son who served in the American military overseas, came home from his service and was in Brick Towers for a brief period of time. And Miss Jones had a neighbor of hers that started pounding on her door. She opened the door. The neighbor couldn't speak, was in tears, grabbed Miss Jones, dragged her down 5 flights of stairs into the lobby, and there was Miss Jones' son on his back, bleeding the floor of the lobby floor red. And Miss Jones says she fell to her knees and started wailing and crying, and her son was murdered in Newark. And she tells me the story, and this is the part that I found myself holding on to and clinging on to. She tells me the story, and I'm looking at this old woman, and this happened, you know, well over a decade ago, and I'm looking at her, and I said, Miss Jones, I said, you and me, she and I were two of the only people that were paying market rent to be in these buildings. And I said, I know where you work, Miss Jones. I know the money you make. I said, you don't have to live here. I said, Miss Jones, why do you still stay in brick towers? Why are you living here? And she looks at me and she crosses her arms, and by now you know her way. She said, why do I still stay here in brick towers? I said, yeah. Why am I living here in these buildings? I said, yes, Miss Jones. She goes, why am I still in apartment 5A? I said, yes, Miss Jones. And she stuck out her chest and stood up straight, and she said, because I'm in charge of Homeland Security. And I laughed at this woman who is not of many degrees, and not of any high academic attainment, but I just looked at this woman and I realized that in that little simple attitude, she encapsulated to me what are the sustaining ideals of our nation. If you look at the history of humanity, go back to Jerusalem in the year 6970 when the Second Temple fell, go to the fall of Rome in 476, go to the fall of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, you'll see that no civilization ever fails simply because of external threats. They fail because of internal corruption, because of their failure to make manifest the ideals that they believe in, the failure to be who they say they are. And here was this woman who knew more than anybody else that we are not a nation that has lived up to its ideals. That when children stand up and say one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all, that it is aspirational at its best. Here was a woman that witnessed untold tragedies, both personally and in her neighborhood. Here was a woman that was still willing to stand. And she stood with me, standing upon many of the broken dreams of the most profound people who died in that complex. And we had too many people die, from Miss Gloria, who died in front of her children being shot to death, to even Hassan Washington, who died right before I left Brick Towers. Here she stood there, unwilling to be moved, no matter if she was going to be taken by this earth by God and still not to see the manifestation of her dreams. She still stood. And to me, ultimately, that is the challenge to us. We've inherited this nation from people like her, who we will never study, who we will never know, who understood what it meant to be about the public interest, who did not wait around to be told, who did not read law books and acquiesce to that which is. They constantly said, I'm going to shape this country around my highest and most profound ideals for myself. I'm going to bring a deeper, richer, more textured, more nuanced idea of this nation, and I'm going to make that real. There is a quote that I often end with because it comes from my favorite book by James Baldwin, and simply this, and I'll paraphrase it a little bit to shorten. Baldwin, at the end of a book that is just as poignant as some of the words I just said, at the end of the book, The Fire Next Time, says, he turns to his audience of readers and says, I know what I'm asking you is impossible, but in today's day and age, the impossible is the least we can demand. And one is, after all, emboldened by the spectacle of human history in particular, in general, and Negro history in particular, for it testifies to nothing less than the perpetual achievement of the impossible. And if we, and by we, I mean the truly conscious blacks and the truly conscious whites, who must, like lovers, come together and insist upon and create the consciousness of all, if we now do not make a sacrifice, be willing to dare it all, then we are destined to recreate the Bible prophecy made real in the Negro spiritual, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water the fire next time. I'm telling you right now, the fires in Newark are going to rage again. And they will not be the fires of riot and rebellion like we saw in 67. They will be the fires of hope, of opportunity, of love, the very torch of what the American dream is and should be and must be about. Thank you very much.